I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. As the President and First Lady joined troops at a service at Fort Hood in Texas for the victims of last week's shooting spree, new and disturbing details are emerging about the alleged shooter's behavior. At Fort Hood, awaiting deployment to Afghanistan, Major Nidal Malik Hassan told friends his Muslim faith made it impossible for him to fight. But before Fort Hood, he did his residency at Walter Reed Hospital in Washington. NPR's Daniel Zwerdling spoke with many of his colleagues, and Daniel joins us from the NPR studios in Washington. Welcome.
Hi, Robin.
What were some of the signs that all was not right with Major Hassan?
Colleagues who worked with him say they were, from the early days, very, very troubled by his behavior as a psychiatrist. We're going to put aside all the talk about his Muslim beliefs right now. They say he was often detached. He seemed uninterested. He wasn't focused. He didn't do the basic things a psychiatrist is supposed to do, like keep good patient notes. You know, if you're supposing you're in the hospital, you want your doctors, right, to chart, you know, here's Robin's mood swings from day to day. Here's the medication she's taking. Here's how we change the medication. And he sometimes wouldn't even keep the most basic notes like that. So a doctor would inherit a case he had been working on, and they'd have no idea that your medications had been changed, that sort of thing.
And we also reported that when he was on call, he would not answer the phone?
That's right. And according to one source I talked to, who worked closely with him, he would just have these lame excuses about, my phone was in the next room or something. So supervisors repeatedly warned him informally that, he needed to shape up. Now, there's something called the policy committee, and they oversee the residents. And I talked with a key official who monitors what goes on in that committee, and he told me that the policy committee actually got reports that Major Hassan had tried to essentially convert one of his patients. He had said to the patient, you know, Islam can save your soul. And so he was reprimanded for that. But the point is, over the years, some of the people there thought he was a really substandard performer.
Well, we also are hearing about a lecture that was delivered at the culmination of his residency. It was supposed to be on a medical topic of his choosing. He chose Islam, specifically Dana Priest of the Washington Post reporting that the slide said it was the Quranic world view as it relates to Muslims in the military. It could describe his state of mind, because he ended by saying that the recommendation was that Muslims in the military be given the option of being released as conscientious objectors to decrease adverse events. Now, we're being told that colleagues later told him at Fort Hood that he could choose a CO status, but he didn't. I guess I'm just asking, what are people at Walter Reed telling you now in hindsight about that slideshow?
I have talked with sources who were in the auditorium and heard it. They said what made some people uncomfortable was the fact that this is a grand rounds. And when you give a grand rounds as a doctor, you're supposed to give a kind of academic talk about, for example, modalities of treating schizophrenia, you know. But this isn't what Hassan did. He gave this lecture about the Quran and about Muslims. And some people were really troubled by it. And I said to sources, now, is it possible that even though this is an unconventional grand rounds lecture, it's not academic in terms of medicine, isn't it possible he was really doing you a service by educating you about Islam? And people said to me, you had to be there and hear the tone to understand why some people were so upset. They said that he seemed to be saying, this is what I believe.
Well, but you report that at one point a new person took over as head of residency and allegedly told colleagues that he didn't think that Hassan should carry the Walter Reed name. What happened? Why wasn't something done?
I want to stress, though, that the psychiatrists who've told me there was this deep concern, they say the concern was not about his Muslim beliefs. When the new director came in, Scott Moran, he reportedly was upset because the guy was underperforming so chronically. He reportedly told colleagues, look, this we should have gotten rid of Hassan a long time ago. And here's the problem. And this is a much bigger problem than Walter Reed. This is a problem at medical institutions around the country. It is very, very difficult in the medical profession to get rid of somebody unless they've done something egregious. And so at Walter Reed, there's this manual I got a hold of, and on page 62, it starts going through all the things you have to do if you want to get rid of a resident. You have to have a long paper trail. You have to show how people counseled the resident. You know, this is a very, very involved process. So they felt, first of all, we don't have a good case. in order to get rid of them. And number two, a couple people wondered out loud, you know, how would it look if we get rid of one of the very few Muslims in our program?
Daniel Zwerdling, we're coming close to the clock here, but how are people at Walter Reed feeling today about what happened and the concerns they had then?
I haven't heard anybody say, we should have known. I've talked to two psychiatrists who've said, you know, we would sit around, you know, a couple years ago saying, is this the kind of guy who might someday become unhinged? One psychiatrist told me that he'd stand around with colleagues saying, do you think Hassan is a terrorist or is he just weird?
Really?
But they say this doesn't mean that they could have or should have been able to predict his behavior. On the other hand, one of the psychiatrists who worked closely with him said to me, when I heard that Nidal Hassan had allegedly shot dozens of people in Texas, I was not surprised at all. This completely fit the Nidal Hassan I knew.
That's NPR's Daniel Zwerdling. Daniel, thank you so much for your reporting on Walter Reed and obviously in the past. Thank you.
Robin, thank you.
Okay. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is heading to Washington today to meet with White House officials ahead of next month's climate change conference in Copenhagen. One of the most contentious issues? Trees. 10 years ago, General Motors and other big American companies brokered a deal with the conservation group The Nature Conservancy to buy up 50,000 acres of Brazilian forests and preserve them. In return, GM hopes the trees will count against carbon emissions in the U.S. But not everyone is happy. Let's find out about this today from Mark Shapiro, senior correspondent for the Center for Investigative Reporting in Berkeley, California. He writes about this in this month's Mother Jones magazine. And Mark, what is GM hoping for? These are called avoided deforestation credits.
That describes a process where a company that emits greenhouse gases into the atmosphere can purchase forests in other parts of the world and agree to do essentially nothing to those forests, meaning they won't cut them down and thereby offset their own emissions at home.
Okay, well, it would seem like a really good thing, and, you know, we've heard for a couple decades now, save the rainforest. But as you point out, there are questions about this. We want to get to that. But first, you went to this area in Brazil where GM is joined by Chevron and American Electric Power in purchasing up to 50,000 acres of Brazilian rainforest. They did this back in 2002. So first of all, what's the place like?
Walking through the forest there, you see flowers that you've never seen before, orchids just growing wild along the pathways. Mm. You hear the sounds of monkeys like the golden lion tamarin, amazing birds, a fantastic, rich, fertile zone of the world that is, in fact, very much like it was thousands of years ago.
And how do these companies know what's in those trees?
Well, this is the big challenge of avoided deforestation, is how do you ascertain precisely how much carbon is loaded in each tree? So let's go back to a tree. What is a tree? A tree is our partner in respiration. We humans exhale carbon dioxide and we inhale oxygen. Trees exhale oxygen and inhale carbon dioxide. This is one of the few natural ways where carbon is sunk in a tree rather than released into the atmosphere.
That's why it's called a carbon sink.
That's how forests are now referred to globally, really, as a carbon sink. Mm. So how do you measure carbon in a tree? Well, I went out to the forest, and this is in the southeast corner of Brazil, and it's called the Atlantic Forest. And I took a walk with somebody who was actually measuring carbon.
This is a man with the Brazilian conservation group Society for Wildlife Research and Environmental Education, or SPVS. They're in charge of managing this land that GM and others have purchased.
Exactly. He walks around with a troop of rangers in this reserve. And they measure the circumference of the tree. They look upwards and they estimate the altitude of the tree. And they multiply the circumference by the altitude to come up with how much carbon is in a tree. And roughly speaking, about 50% of each tree is made of carbon. And so they can then multiply by how many trees are in the reserve and begin to estimate how much carbon may be sunk in this reserve.
But you point out that GM has such a huge carbon footprint that these trees in this reserve wouldn't offset, you know, GM's carbon footprint, but GM might be able to sell this carbon as a credit to other companies that need to offset their carbon footprint. So it's turning these trees into a commodity that gets bought and sold. But then there's a hitch, because the UN does not have a provision for this project. A lot of people are against this idea. So why?
Yes, this is a highly controversial means of establishing offsets. Let's go back a little bit. Kyoto, 12 years ago, we all know what happened after Kyoto. The United States pulled out of Kyoto in 2001. The companies had every reason to believe that while the United States was in Kyoto initially, and even when we pulled out, that the international community would actually permit forests to be used as offsets and that they could sell those offsets on the international market. However, in 2004, the international body that regulates the offset trade globally determined that the purchase of avoided deforestation offset credits was not acceptable.
And again, this is the program of buying trees that already exist, because they do have
right.
a provision that allows you to get offset credits if you plant trees.
Yes. So very clear distinction. And the UN system permits companies to take an area of denuded land, for example, and replant trees on that land. What it specifically does not permit is this idea of avoided deforestation.
Why are they against that?
Number one, the unpredictability of measuring carbon in a tree. Each species soaks up carbon at a different rate. It depends on the altitude. It depends on the moisture level in the ground. It depends on the plants that are surrounding that tree. And so there's wide variation in how you can create a predictable commodity out of that tree. A second great concern is the potential for what they call leakage. It means that, okay, you stop deforestation here in one area, but then it just simply moves somewhere else, because a lumber company simply moves the operation somewhere else, having absolutely no overall effect on emissions.
You have a couple other reasons that are fascinating. For instance, there's a fear that a country would threaten to open its lands to logging, for instance, if someone didn't pay them for their trees, so it could be sort of an extortion. And also, there are countries who are, you know, as you write, leery of selling off their trees.
Yes, there is a kind of iconic image of somebody holding an axe next to a tree saying, pay me or I'm going to cut this down. And many countries actually object to their forests being utilized in that way, including Brazil. Brazil, of course, objects strenuously to this kind of calculation of their forests, because they don't want to be selling off their national treasures and their forests to individual companies and hitching the fate of their forests to the emission programs of American
right.
companies.
Well, and also, what about the Brazilian people who rely on those forests for their food and livelihoods? That's Mark Shapiro, senior correspondent for the Center for Investigative Reporting in Berkeley, California. He writes about the so-called money trees in this month's Mother Jones magazine. We'll have more with him in a minute. Also, a reminder, later today, we're going to try to untangle that debate over the abortion amendment in the House health care bill. That's later today. Back in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're talking today about whether huge carbon-producing corporations in the U.S. should be allowed to buy up forests in other countries to try to offset their carbon emissions. It's called avoided deforestation credits. There are strange bedfellows in favor of this. The U.S.-based Nature Conservancy was involved in a deal to sell trees in Brazil to General Motors and other corporations. They say that preserves the trees, but there are downsides. We've been talking about that with Mark Shapiro. He writes about some of them in Mother Jones magazine. Mark, let's get right to it. What happens to the indigenous people who live in these forests?
This whole reserve is lined with small little villages of subsistence farmers who basically traditionally have lived off the land. And the reserve was set up, and around the reserve are now a whole array of restrictions on people's ability to go into the forest and obtain, for example, trees to build their homes or the fruits that grow on the plants or even to hunt. So what's happened is that numerous people have actually been displaced from their own land. We visited villages that had been abandoned, old huts left empty because people could no longer sustain themselves in the forest. And they end up in the town, unemployed, unable to adapt essentially to life in the urban cities. We're talking about the state of Paraná in southeastern Brazil. And the state capital there is called Curitiba. And many of these refugees who come from this reserve end up in Curitiba. And some officials actually told us that they end up either in the drug trade or prostitution or just desperately unemployed, unable to sustain themselves any longer. So you couldn't help but get a sense of the irony at work, where because of the restrictions now placed on the land to enable it to function as a predictable carbon offset to American emitters, people who have a minute carbon footprint are displaced from the land. And this is a very critical part as the United States moves forward when it considers how to adapt forest offsets to think of people who actually live there.
Right. Well, some people are pushing for indigenous people to have informed consent before a sale goes through. Some want tribes that have long lived in these forests to be compensated for how well they preserved the forests for centuries. But meanwhile, as you write, we're heading on a collision course now. These huge corporations, GM, Chevron, have made a bet. They've invested millions of dollars in purchasing up these trees, hoping that laws would change so that they could buy and sell these trees or use them as carbon offsets. And how are they faring in this big lobbying effort?
They've been quite successful. In the United States, a very strong lobby has emerged from major industry groups in alliance with some of the big environmental organizations like the Nature Conservancy and the Natural Resources Defense Council and others to put forest offsets in the American system. And what looks very likely to happen in both the House bill, Waxman-Markey, and the Senate bill, which is a Kerry Graham bill, both of them have major provisions for utilizing forest offsets by American companies. And so this looks very likely to be one of the main ways that American industries are able to offset their emissions. Let me give you an example of what that means. A Blue Ribbon Commission came out with a report in October, which estimated that the amount of money it would cost to buy the forests to offset the emissions of American companies would be about $10 billion. If they were to impose their own emission reduction technology here at home, it would cost more like around $50 billion. Hmm. So there's an enormous cost incentive that is actually partly driving this debate.
Right. I mean, why not invest in a tree in Brazil if that's less expensive than changing the way you produce things?
Exactly. The American approach is putting the United States on a direct collision course with the other major player in these negotiations, which is the European Union.
Because they don't allow avoided deforestation offsets.
Exactly. And because of that, I think this question of avoided deforestation is going to be one of the major and most contentious issues that are going to be faced in Copenhagen.
Well, Mark Shapiro, obviously yours is a cautionary tale about this. And I'm just wondering, is there anything that you see, you know, you have the Nature Conservancy, the Environmental Defense Fund, the Natural Resources Defense Council, all advocating for it? We should point out Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth don't like these ideas. They say it holds forests hostage to the price of carbon and, you know, makes them into a commodity, as we said. But, you know, there are big players in favor of this. What do you see that's positive about this? I mean, again, we heard for years, save the trees, save the rainforest. This is saving the rainforest.
Exactly. This is one of the great ironies of this situation. I mean, of course, deforestation contributes to about 20% of the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. It's imperative that some way to deal with saving the forests be developed, you know, on a global scale. And so there's no question that the forests need to be standing. They need to keep standing in order to stave off climate change that we're all trying to, or the levels of climate change that we're trying to avoid.
Right, but in order to breathe, they have to breathe in that carbon dioxide and store it. And by the way, we should say, when they're cut down, obviously they can't store carbon anymore, but all the carbon that's in them gets released.
Exactly. And essentially acts in the atmosphere very similar to the way emissions from industries act in the atmosphere. My point is that there is a central principle at stake here in the evolution of the offset and cap-and-trade system, which enables major industries in developed countries to pursue offsets in foreign countries that enable them to detour the requirement that they reduce their own emissions at home. Now, utilizing forests in this kind of way raises a whole array of questions around measurement and other issues that we've discussed. And I think as we move forward, it's important to move forward without a sense of self-delusion. That self-delusion holds a very simple equation. I emit here. I'm American company X. I emit so much in the United States. If I can only buy a forest in another country somewhere in the world, then it equalizes out my emissions and makes me into a neutral emitter. Well, no, it doesn't always work like that. And to approach this with that sense of illusion, I think, is the biggest danger.
That's Mark Shapiro, senior correspondent for the Center for Investigative Reporting. Together with PBS's Frontline World and Mother Jones, they took a look at avoided deforestation credits, this credit swapping he was just talking about. We'll have a link to the Frontline video as well as to Mark's reporting at our website, herenow.org. Mark, thank you so much.
Thanks.
Okay, still to come today, he's Big Bird, he's Oscar, he's both, after the news, here and now. John Allen Muhammad, the so-called Beltway sniper, is scheduled to be put to death tonight in Washington. He'll have a last meal. Will he have any last words? And if so, will anyone record them? They would if he were in Texas. It's a ghoulish thought, but the state of Texas Department of Criminal Justice has compiled the last words of every prisoner executed in that state since 1982 and made them available online. Writer Claire Cameron looked through them and selected some for an op-ed in the New York Times earlier this year, and she joins us from her home in Ontario, Canada. And Claire, we know one of the characters in your last novel, the line painter, is a criminal, and so that started your research. But then what happened?
Well, it really stuck with me. I think at the time I read a few of the statements, and, frankly, they took my breath away. I thought of them almost as artifacts from the edge of a life, something you don't see very often.
Well, you assembled what you read into different common themes or recurring sentiments you saw.
Yeah.
One of them, the throat clearing. What do you mean by that?
One of the things that came through were sort of procedural, so either someone clearing a throat or at the opening of their statement saying, is the mic on, or expressing surprise that so many people are viewing the execution. And I think in that way they sort of hint at the larger story.
A lot of the soon-to-be-executed addressed families.
That's what I found as I read through all these, more than 400 statements, was that there were sort of themes to what people said. So some, accepted guilt, some claimed innocence, some were angry and defiant, whereas many others were resigned. Some apologized to victims' family, for example. There's quite a bit of praying and quoting of scripture. And I think the most common thing was that people expressed love for family and friends.
Well, here are some of the quotes. I want to tell my mom that I love her. I love you, Irene. Let my son know I love him. That was one.
Mm-hmm.
Where's Mr. Marino's mother? Did she get my letter? Do you have some more there?
Yeah. One man said, my heart is going ba-bump, ba-bump, ba-bump. And that was the first thing he said, which really made me, on a human level, feel the sort of terror. Others, Lord, I lift your name on high. They were praying. Mm-hmm. Some that I included at the end, I'm tired, I deserve this, a life for life. It's my hour. It's my hour.
Here's another. Could you please tell that lady right there, can I see her? She's not looking at me. I want you to understand something. Hold no animosity toward me. I want you to understand. Please forgive me.
Mm-hmm. Someone addressing the victim's family, presumably, which I think the Texas Board of Criminal Justice adopted a rule that permitted victims' families to witness executions in 1996. Yeah. So you started to see more of that during that time.
They are profoundly sad. Some might make you angry if you think they're too flip. But one or two made you laugh?
Yeah, that was a very odd thing. There's I did read them all. I went through a lot of things, and I did cry sometimes. I did, I was scared. I was very angry. You can look through and see the crimes that people committed as well. But then there's just these little moments, like someone saying, tell everyone I got the full-on chicken and pork chops, and he's talking about the last meal that he received. Or, tell the guys in death row that I'm not wearing a diaper. Sort of, you got a sense of the camaraderie it was a very odd thing, and I felt kind of sick for laughing, but there was this sort of humor, this spark of humanness, I guess, that came through.
Overall, are you glad you read them or sorry you read them?
Yeah, that's a very good question, because I'm glad I did. I think these words have struck people from all sorts of political persuasions. I've gotten emails from people all over the place in U.S., Canada, and England as well. So on one hand, I'm glad that the words are out. On the other hand, it's, you know, I do get sort of a dark feeling every time I read them or address the subject. It's quite a heavy one, because you can put yourself in the place of what this might feel like.
That's writer Claire Cameron. Claire, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Robin.
And with that warning about the dark feeling, we'll link you to the last words on the Texas Department of Criminal Justice's website at our site, hereandnow.org. And be back after a quick break with a close look at the language about abortion in the House health care reform bill in 30 seconds, here and now. President Obama weighed in last night on the fierce battle over abortion that's brewing in health care reform. Obama told ABC News that he's not comfortable with an amendment which the House passed last weekend that he says restricts abortion coverage.
I think that there are strong feelings on both sides, and what that tells me is that there needs to be some more work before we get to the point where we're not changing the status quo, and that's the goal.
The status quo, current federal law bans public funds, usually Medicaid, from paying for abortions. But states have their own laws. 17 states allow the state portion of Medicaid money to pay for abortions. 5 states ban insurers from providing abortion coverage at all. So how would the House passed bill change abortion coverage? Would it change it at all? Let's spend a few minutes delving into that with Alec McGillis, national politics reporter for The Washington Post. Alec, what exactly does the amendment that the House put forward say?
The amendment says that there can be no abortion coverage offered in any government-run insurance options, the so-called public option that the House bill would create. And so people joining this public option under our new reform would not be able to get abortions in that public option, period. They could, you know, they can pay for it out of their own pocket. They can, you know, there are various programs out there, of course, that do subsidize the cost of abortions, but it would not be covered by their insurance plan.
Uh-huh. And in addition, there is something called a health insurance exchange, which will also be government-run. Explain what that is.
Well, the exchange is really where this is all, where all the action is happening. The public option is going to be offered on this exchange. It's basically just a virtual marketplace. It's where people without employer-based coverage and small businesses will be going to buy their insurance after this reform is passed. People will go to this so-called exchange where they're going to be able to choose from various insurance plans. The public option will be one of the plans on that exchange.
Yeah. And on this exchange, people who don't happen to get employer-based insurance might be able, for instance, to join a group that's formed by a company on the exchange, and therefore they can have the benefits of group coverage. But how would the amendment regarding abortion affect those people getting private insurance on the exchange, and it doesn't have any, you know, subsidy attached?
That's where things get tricky. The amendment would not only ban abortion coverage in the public option, it would ban abortion coverage in any other private plan that's offered on this exchange that's going to be available to people who are using government subsidies to help them buy their insurance. And effectively what that means is that probably any plan on this exchange would not offer abortion coverage, because plans offered on this exchange, that the insurers would want them to be available to people who have government subsidies, who are helping using government subsidies to buy their insurance.
So you might not be buying into, let's say, a group plan on that exchange using government subsidies, but someone else might.
Exactly. A lot of the people in this exchange are going to be coming with government subsidies to help them buy insurance.
Right.
And there's supposed to be about 30 million people at the outset buying insurance on this exchange. A lot of them will have subsidies, because the subsidies are available to people up to about $66,000 of family income. So a lot of people will have these subsidies. And why you would offer a policy to one segment of your customers that's different only in the sense that it covers abortion? I mean, I don't see how that works. I don't even know how you would advertise such a plan.
And so if you keep following this line of thinking, this amendment wouldn't directly affect women who get their health insurance through their employers unless that insurance company that they are offered through their employer is one of those that also wants to be on this health exchange and go after this lucrative new market of uninsured people, in which case they may stop offering abortion even to people who get their insurance through work?
Well, that's where things get even more thorny, is trying to foresee how that's going to play out. It's possible that an insurer that does have people signed up through employer-based coverage will offer a different kind of insurance product on the marketplace that will not include abortion coverage. They don't have to have all of their products all of one type. In that sense, it's quite possible that people who are getting employer coverage will continue to keep their current employer coverage that does include abortion coverage. Where I think the real question comes in is what will happen as more and more people go into this exchange. The likelihood is that this exchange is over time going to become the place where more and more of us get our coverage as they kind of loosen the boundaries for who gets to go into this exchange, and more employers maybe shift their coverage into the exchange. So that's why the rules on this exchange might be relevant for a broader number of people,
right?
Because over time the exchange could be where the action is.
Well, and you write that the amendment suggests that women might be able to buy a separate rider from these private companies that covers abortion. How would those work?
Well, there are, one can purchase riders on top of your normal insurance policy for different things. And so conceivably, you could have some kind of an overlay that would go on top of the policy you got on the exchange. The abortion rights folks say that this is outrageous, that to expect women to buy a rider for this one procedure, which for, most women obviously is very unexpected, that it's just highly offensive to expect them to be thinking about this and to go and purchase this one extra thing on top of the covers that everyone else is getting.
Yeah. Well, the abortion amendment passed in the House, not with just a handful of Democrats, but with, 64 Democrats in the House. And now there are, I think, about 40 Democrats saying going forward, they allowed this to go through because they understood that there were vulnerable congressmen who could not vote for abortion rights. But these 40 Democrats are saying they're not going to let it remain in the final bill. What's the thinking of this battle as it goes forward?
Oh, it's just incredibly messy. First of all, with the people who voted for the amendment, it is worth noting there were 64 of them, and there were about two dozen of them who ended up voting for the final bill with the amendment in it. So that's what we're really dealing with. We're dealing with about two dozen House Democrats who want to support health care reform, but who want to have some assurance in the bill that it's not going to lead to federal funding of abortions. And it's also worth noting that not all of those Democrats are actually abortion rights opponents. They're pro-choice but against the federal funding of abortions. So they're basically looking for some kind of language that could give them assurance.
And by the way, what would it be? If there's going to be such a thing as a government-run health insurance exchange, and if most of the people coming to it are going to have some form of government subsidy, what would language be that would encourage private insurers to offer abortion coverage if they want to join the health insurance exchange?
You've just put your finger on it. It's virtually impossible to come up with something that's going to satisfy both sides on this. It's going to be very, very tricky.
Alec McGillis, national politics reporter for The Washington Post. Thanks for walking us through this.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
And, of course, we'd love to hear your thoughts on this or anything on the program. Just go to hereandnow.org and click on Contact Us up on the right there to send an email. Or you could just scroll down and leave a comment right there on the homepage. When we come back, the woman who stopped the train in 1 minute, Here and Now. You might have seen the video. It's gone viral. It was taken inside a Boston train station. We call it the T here in Boston. It shows a woman falling on the tracks, the train approaching, people on the platform frantically waving, trying to alert the driver of the train, which screeches to a halt just in front of the woman. Charisse Lewis was driving that train.
They were waving a little bit too much, and they were really, really close to the yellow line, which they're not supposed to be. So that's obviously telling me, slow your train down, slow your train down. And then as I'm approaching, the lady pops her head up, and I'm like, oh, my God, someone's in the pit. So I just threw it in emergency, exactly what I'm supposed to do, and it stopped just in time not to hurt her.
Yesterday, Ms. Lewis and a colleague who called her from the platform, Jacqueline Osorio, were hailed as heroes. That woman who fell on the tracks suffered some scrapes. She told authorities she'd been drinking. The moral of the story, perhaps take a designated walker with you to the train. The video's at our website, hereandnow.org.
Hi, everyone. We are here digging up soil because we're about to plant a garden.
Yeah. So we can grow our very own food.
Right. We're planting vegetables like these right here. And veggies taste so good when they come fresh from the garden, don't they?
Oh, yeah.
So now what we need to do...
First Lady Michelle Obama talking about one of her favorite topics, locally grown food, on this, the 40th anniversary of that public television institution, Sesame Street. From the beginning, one of the most beloved residents of Sesame Street has been the 8'2" big yellow bird with the heart of a child, Big Bird.
Well, I'm not all alone. Why, there's Gordon and Susan.
But they're not birds like we are.
I know, but they're nice people.
But you should have a home and a family.
Well, I am home. I like it here on Sesame Street.
When Big Bird was born, Jim Henson's Muppets were already huge stars. When Jim Henson died, it was Big Bird who sang at his funeral. And while Big Bird and his neighbor Oscar the Grouch may not share the same outlook on life, they have the same heart and soul. A guy named Carol Spinney. Carol paid a visit to our studios in 2004 to talk about his work, which he wrote about in the book The Wisdom of Big Bird and the Dark Genius of Oscar the Grouch, Lessons from a Life in Feathers. And in honor of Sesame Street's birthday, we thought we'd visit him again. I read in your book that Big Bird started out as kind of a local yokel. And when did he become a child?
Well, it wasn't long that he was a local yokel. Jim Henson had personally discovered me doing my own show called Pickle Puss and Friends. To me, it was like if I was a drummer, he'd say, I've got a little band from Liverpool. Would you like to be me drummer then? And it was Jim Henson asking me. I couldn't believe it. He built the bird around me, and he asked, I asked him, what is he like? And he said, gee, I've been thinking of him as a puppet, but I haven't thought who he's going to be. He said, well, maybe it's like a nice, amiable, goofy guy like Goofy, Mickey Mouse's pal. And we weren't doing the show very long before I said, you know, I think it'd be better if he were a child, because he's trying to learn the alphabet, and he wanted to join a bunch of little kids in a daycare center in one of our scenes. And I said, I don't think you'd want him there as Goofy, but I think he might be there as a child who hasn't learned much yet, even though he's 8'2".
I also just worship Jim Henson, and his passing was just horrendous. And so I was devastated to read that he wasn't all that sentimental about
the characters.
Well,
I'm almost sorry I put it that way, because it sounds like he was cold. There was nothing cold about him. He just was he was a true genius.
But he was surprised that you talked to the puppets,
well, I guess I'm a little silly maybe, but Ernie, he had to drop on the floor because he had a quick change to another puppet. And so Ernie was in his way, and he kind of shoved him aside with his foot. And I picked Ernie up and said, gee, Ernie, he didn't mean that. And he said, why, are you sentimental about the puppets? And I said, well, yeah, I guess if the character that you build for them eventually becomes quite real to you.
Yeah. And does that say something about you and what you brought to Big Bird? Because you've said that the most important component of Big Bird to you is compassion.
Well, that's what I kind of developed. First he became the child, and he was kind of sweet and amiable. And he also was able to get angry and pout and do all the things that kids can do. But one day, actually, I was walking back from Sesame Street, and this little old man, he looked kind of upset. And he was standing there, and I said, is there anything wrong, sir? And he said, well, I haven't been well, and I'm living alone. And if I fall, there's no one to take care of me. I said, well, would you like to take my arm? And I walked him a few blocks, and he thanked me. The next day, I just couldn't get it out of my mind, and I went to work the next day, and I suggested to one of our producers, couldn't Big Bird do something to teach compassion?
Yeah.
And she said, well, maybe you can just put it into his character. About 3 years later, I was reading a newspaper telling about the different characters. He said, and then there's the compassionate Big Bird. And I said, yes, success. I must have done something right.
And it is. It's Big Bird that cries with Mr. Snuffleupagus when they have discussion about whether or not they can have imaginary friends turn out not to be imaginary. And
right.
it's Big Bird that cries when he learns that Mr. Hooper has died, and all the children watching learn. I'm getting a little choked up when I talk about it. You know, so it's Big Bird that brought those moments to us.
Yes, and it was that was what I realized I'd gone a long way from just being, you know, I was Grandma Nellie the clown on Bozo Show.
Well, you know, it's the most amazing thing. Everywhere Big Bird is, you are. It's just the weirdest thing. And so I'm wondering, is Big Bird here now?
I'll see. Big Bird?
What is it?
Come here a minute.
Oh, hi. Who's this?
Hi, Big Bird. It's Robin.
Oh, hello, Robin. You don't look like a bird.
That's right. You're the bird. You're a Big Bird. How old are you?
Well, I'm 6 now.
Ah.
Bird years, though.
Oh.
Not quite the same as yours.
No. Well, Big Bird, I know you've been doing a lot of interviews along with your friend.
Mm-hmm.
Big Bird, what's the silliest thing people are asking you? Because people can ask the silliest things.
Well, this morning, somebody asked me all about what's my opinion about dating.
Oh.
I didn't know what that word means.
When they tell you about the birds and the... Oh, wait, you already know about the birds.
Yeah, I'm one of them. Oscar, get out of the... He's in your wastebasket. Oscar.
No.
Hey, look, I'm looking for good stuff in here. I love trash.
Hi, Oscar.
We all know that, Oscar.
Oscar, you know what I want to know? Oscar, are you really as grouchy as people say?
I'm a little grouchier than that. Particularly today, I got up on the right side of the bed. Oh. I hate that.
Yeah. Big Bird, how do you... You know, Oscar sometimes can be so grouchy, and, you know, he's making a mess right now in our garbage can.
Oscar, you're making a mess.
How do you...
Good.
How do you feel about that, Big Bird? Sometimes he's kind of rude.
Yeah, but he's nice. I kind of like most people. He just pulls lots of tricks on me. And he also calls me an overgrown bag of giblets.
Hey, I'm glad to make you unhappy. Oscar, you want to make him unhappy? Well, not exactly. I like to frustrate the turkey.
I'm not a turkey!
Okay, all right. No, we're not going to fight. Do you find yourself talking to Big Bird and Oscar a lot?
Yeah, I often feel that Big Bird is sort of like a little boy to me. I'm glad to know him. Mm. And he's not me, but yet I seem to feel I know him very well, and I have a very fatherly feeling towards him.
Yeah.
Me too?
No, not you.
Well, we want to thank you for bringing him and Oscar to us. I mean, you know, it's funny. Some people have their inner child, and Big Bird and Oscar have their inner adult.
Yeah, I guess they do.
That's you. Thank you.
It's nice to be here.
Bye.
Bye.
Have a rotten day.